God's out there. He just doesn't care. He's off doing God stuff. And that this is part of the secular view. If there is a God, he's just really not that into us. Then we get to Pelagianism. And for those of you in the back, I'll read you what it says. This is from a Beetle Bailey cartoon. It says, "What if you could see in the future and saw your life was miserable?" The guy replies, "I'd keep on plugging away." And Beetle replies, really, why? He says, "Hey, the future could be wrong." So this is that Pelagian idea that we're working, that the future is kind of open, and we're going to do it on our own. So it's Pelagianism, which is it's one of those 50-cent theological words, but it's good to remember. So we get back to modern morals, and modern morals are Pelagianism plus deism. So we're plugging away because the future could be wrong, and God's really not that into us. And that gives us modern morals. And this is a quote from Jamie Smith, the professor who wrote the book. He says, "Secularists would have us believe the secular world is a cool, monolithic, rational age where everyone lives in quiet confidence." But we know that idea of quiet confidence, yeah, it might be cool, it might be monolithic, it may be rational, but the last piece, that everyone's living in quiet confidence, that's debatable. I think that actually said quite confidence, not quiet. That was a spell check error, or relying on spell check error. Once belief becomes an option, believers begin to have doubts. They wonder if there is something more. So this is an interesting problem that the secularists have, is that once they offer, since our culture now we don't live in Christendom anymore, where there's this, you know, contestability of belief, everything's open. Well, now unbelief is an option. That causes some problems internally for people. All of a sudden, once unbelief, atheism, becomes an option, they wonder if there's something more. A tension develops in people. And that tension is where we're going to be looking in the coming weeks. And then lastly, Acts 17, Mars Hill. Paul says, "What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you." We know that in the hearts of the secular world, and as we're going to look at it in the coming weeks and especially today, there is a draw. They know there's something there. The argument that atheists are somehow taking over the world is not true. There is nothing to support that. Even though, you know, our newspapers and many people in academia would want us to believe that atheism is the future. Stalin tried that and it didn't really work. So it's not the future. They are not winning. There's nothing to bear that out statistically, anecdotally, just in our daily lives. What we do know is that there are unbelievers. They have lots of questions. And today we're going to kind of look at how does the secular world worship? We are worshiping animals. St. Augustine said that man is curvitas in se. He is bent in on himself. When there's nothing to worship, he worships himself. But we all know there is something outside of ourselves, and the secular world is worshiping, and we're going to look at some of those worship practices today. We're going to look at two specifically. So, we'll move on to week 4. So we have our definition, again, contestability. The contestability this time is going to be how people worship, and we are going to see how the secular world does worship. Now, there's a lot of small letters, and I apologize for that. The slides are not just for you, they're for me, so I remember where I am, so I'm not looking at notes. This way I can look at over here and I can turn around. Transcendence. Transcendence is that big idea, that draw to something larger than ourselves. The idea that something is bigger than us, that there's a God. Some might call it God, some might call it Yahweh, some might call it something else, Shiva maybe. But the idea that there's something bigger in the secular world. That transcendence is what causes that conflict in people. Because even though they're drawn to science, they're drawn to nature, they're drawn to materialism, they still have this nagging feeling in their heart that there's something else going on. There's something bigger than us. Winston Churchill said that there's things going on in time and space and outside time and space. It's that idea that there's something going on outside time and space that causes people internal conflict. So, Jamie Smith says, this felt flatness, that there's something more, can manifest itself in different ways at different times. For example, it can be felt with particular force in rites of passage in life. And we've discussed this at length. Birth, marriage, death. The secular world creates rites of passage. And they draw on, especially in the Western world, Christianity, to develop these rites of passage. Because it provides them a comfort, and it provides them a narrative for life. A baby is born, what do we do? Interesting thing about Christianity in the Western world when it comes to infants. Christianity and Judaism were the only religions, until Islam came along, that believed that children had inherent value. If we think about that for a second, prior to Christianity and Judaism, or outside of Christianity and Judaism, I should say, the pagan world, the unbelieving world, had no problem taking a child who was born with a defect and killing them. That was normal. Outside of the Judeo-Christian world, fathers were not involved in the care of children because they didn't really matter until they got older. Parents didn't love their children until they got to a certain age for survivability reasons, because the child was not looked at as something that had inherent value. This was something that one day may have value. It's kind of like a warning on a mutual fund. You know, past performance does not guarantee future results. And that was the view that people took of their children. So that effect that Christianity has had on the Western world has gone so deep into the way we look at children and ourselves that even at birth, the secular world draws on Christianity to provide context for those rites of passage. And we see that also in marriage and in death. All of these are being used by the secular world. Next quote, material abundance can engender an existential sense of lack precisely because the swelling of the material world seems unable to make up for the pressure we still feel. So there's a lack, like we've been talking about, and it creates a pressure. And we feel this pressure from transcendence, from enchantment. It's very hard for an atheist to maintain atheism and then go and stand at, you know, the Grand Canyon and go, yeah, this is a function of, you know, the laws of physics, nature, and science, and that's about it. Right. And last week we talked about how they try to pull that out of it. So they try to take, Bach's Gospel of Matthew, and they try to pull it out of the church where it belongs and put it into a secular music hall. And it creates this kind of, disjointedness where we're singing about the resurrection of Christ in the Gospel of Matthew in a secular music hall where people are trying to only appreciate it for the aesthetic musical quality. And it's bizarre. I mean, if we step back from it for a second, you know, it's really kind of strange. How could you listen to Handel's Messiah as a purely, for its purely aesthetic musical qualities and completely devoid it of any faith significance? I mean, I don't know. I don't know anybody that can do that. And if they can, I'd like to know what kind of mental gymnastics they go through to be able to get to that point. So this transcendence, this big idea, this push down, is constantly affecting people, and it actually creates internal pressure. And it has to come out somewhere. And I think a great example of this pressure that people feel is when Christ appears to Paul and he says, and I think that the reason I like the KJV is because the quote is, it comes across better, I think. It says, and this is Jesus speaking to Paul, and when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking unto me and saying in the Hebrew tongue, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks. Now, interesting thing about that last part, it's hard for thee to kick against the pricks, comes from a Greek saying that an ox that kicks only hurts itself. And that's where the secular world is. It's an ox that's kicking because it's under pressure, because it knows there's something bigger, but the only person it's hurting is itself. That's where the gospel comes in. That's where we're able to present salvation in Christ Jesus. So, I'm going to move on to two forms of worship, and I'm going to need, this could be a little bit more interactive, I'm going to need some help describing things. So, the first church of the secular world. Is anybody familiar with TED Talks? I got one. Anyone else? Two? Three? Four? See, there's more of you. You're hiding out there. Someone explain to me what a TED Talk is. Okay. Something like that. Similar.
It's a rah-rah for the soul.
Right.
In
a way.
Cheerleading.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
Anybody else? You got what a TED Talk is? Right, and a lot of times they provide a problem, so there's some kind of issue, a solution is provided, and it provides little things that people can do to solve big issues, really is what we end up seeing in these things. And they find people that are experts. Some of these guys that are talking are really wicked smart. I mean, they are just, they are the experts on their topics. They're really entertaining, so it's infotainment kind of. You can sign up to go for free. So you just put your name on a list, and there's lots of people who want to go in, so your chances are quite small. So if you want to short circuit having to wait in line, you too, for $8,000, can get a seat at one of these. So that seems kind of like a tithe to me, you know, to the secular church. So yeah, $8,000, you get a ticket, you get to go in. Vancouver in Canada. It's an acronym, and I completely forget what it stands for. So, here, sorry? Talking. Yeah, that's part of it. So, the New York Times this year, a lady who grew up in the evangelical church did an article on TED Talks. And even though she is now not a believer, from what I can tell, in the way that she expresses herself in the article, she does say some really interesting stuff. So I'll read it out for those in the back who can't quite see it. It says, TED Talks routinely present problems of huge scale and scope. We imprison too many people. The rainforest is dying. Look at all this garbage. We're unhappy. We have big data and aren't sure what to do with it. Then they wrap it up tidily and tinily. Do this, stop doing that, buy an app that will help you do this other thing. So, going back to what we discussed a couple weeks ago on the gospel of the cross and the gospel of glory, what are we getting down here? What is this? This is the gospel of glory. This is law. People want to be told what to do to solve the problem. They want to be given law because that empowers me to accomplish something. TED Talks, they pump people up. pump them up, you know, get them really excited about this really interesting issue, show lots of graphs and make the graphs do funky things, and then provide somebody something to do to solve the problem and kick them out the door and wait for them to come back next time. We see this in some Christian churches. This is Pelagianism. This is secular Pelagianism. Let's give people stuff to do so they feel like they're under control, they feel like they're having an effect. That's what we see with this part of TED Talks. It's providing people law. So, the next quote, but the truth is, now is a fun time to be a skeptic among true believers, since there are so many types of true believers to choose from. I sometimes wonder whether TED's top 20 list will eventually morph into a creed, or whether, as in the early church, heretics will be asked to leave the party. So here's another interesting issue with the church in secularism and how secularism does worship. Is there a creed in the secular world? Can the secular world identify heretics? I think most of the heretics of the secular world are sitting in this room. Right. And you see it in the philosophical world even too. There was a great book written by an atheist called God in the Cosmos, where he points out the problems in philosophically in arguing against God, the atheistic argument against God. Thomas Nagel. And what happened to Nagel was basically there was a witch hunt and people shouting, "Ban him!" He's a witch, and they went after him. Now, luckily, he's a tenured professor at NYU, and, you know, unless he's caught, you know, killing people on a church lawn in broad daylight with a cop standing there, nothing's going to happen to him. But the personal vindictive attacks that were launched against him was he was a heretic in the secular world. But even so, I mean, let's take something like, you know, regardless of what your I'm going to bring up political issues. I'm not going to give you my opinion necessarily, but I'm using them to point something out. Take something like global warming. If you don't believe in global warming, what happens to you within the secular world? You're a witch, right? Burn him. What happens if you take a stand against, you know, pick another the oil pipeline to be the, what's it called? The Keystone Pipeline. In certain circles, if you say the Keystone Pipeline should be built, you're a witch. If you take, you know, pick an issue. Defunding Planned Parenthood. You know, I mean, so there are these mantras in the secular world that are considered doctrine. They do have their own doctrine. What TED does, and TED doesn't usually get too involved into the hyper-politicized stuff. I mean, I think on global warming, they'll kind of get involved. But generally speaking, they stay out of the hyper-political politicized stuff. But what they do is provide you, you know, these various methods to solve issues that are plaguing the world. And those things that they present are presented as truth. Because it's on a PowerPoint slide, it has to be true. There was an online discussion on Facebook about PowerPoint the last couple of days. The creed that they develop is an example in the secular world. The secular world confesses something. They believe something. And with regard to TED, it's very much a materialistic belief that you get on the secular world. Now, let me back up a second. This does not mean that if you watch TED that you're a secularist. This does not mean that everything that's on a TED talk is wrong. What I'm saying is those people for whom are drawn to this type of display of information, these gatherings, being part of something larger, can become worship-like. And that's what we end up seeing with the TED talk And they do have their own forms of heresy. So, does anyone know what that is? No, close, but not really. She'd be really excited to go to the bathroom, apparently. Anyone? No? Anyone heard of the Burning Man? Okay. This is the symbol for Burning Man. Burning Man is another example of worship. So, a little background on Burning Man. This is Burning Man. It's out near Black Rock, Nevada. It's kind of the descendant of the hippie movement. What goes on at these is you've got a bunch of guys and girls who are generally more in the artsy crowd, more into music, building stuff, hipsters. They go to Black Rock and they set up a city basically in the middle of the desert. And it's a week-long event and there's lots of large art pieces. That church there actually is one of the art pieces that's there. You can see over here, it's kind of tiny on here. There's this piece right here, all built out of wood. Gigantic structures built out of wood. And what they do every night is they burn up these pieces of wood. Another one of their mantras is leave no trace behind. So all of this has to be cleaned up before they leave, and it's supposed to look like no one was ever there. So they get together, they do this, and then they leave. This is a lot different than TED, I think we can see. Aesthetically, I mean, and just kind of the people that would be drawn to it. What do you see how this could potentially fulfill some of that secular worship, the need of transcendence? Can you see that? I mean, here you've got, it kind of goes back to, we talked about football games, right? That can have a worshipful experience to it, the transcendent experience of being in a place with 45,000 other people, you know, all gathered for one thing, or sometimes two, but right, exactly, and that's what we're going to find here. So, right, but you think about the communion that these people are trying to create in a thing like this, you know, the communion that they get, the sense of a larger purpose, a purpose that everybody has together in forming something. You know, one of the ideals is that this is not, you know, supposed to be a place where there's like aggression and anger and whatnot. Hippie kind of ideas. But nonetheless, what you end up with is a pretty cool idea. I mean, set up a gigantic city in the middle of the desert and tear it down and nothing's left. It's pretty neat. And people get to be a part of something larger than they are. So we can see how this all kind of builds a worship aspect into them. So this was actually identified by some scholars up at Wheaton College a number of years ago, and they started sending guys out there to basically study this and figure it out. What exactly is going on at Burning Man? Yeah. It was a couple of weeks ago. Do your guys get involved in that? Because that's on national forest land, BLM land. And I imagine that's not a lot of fun for them, having that many people show up in the middle of the desert. It's a spectrum of people too that show up to them, like you're saying. So what Wheaton did, the scholars at Wheaton identified this as being something that really needs to be looked at, because obviously something's going on. So TED Talks happen all the time, and people have written about those, like we saw in the New York Times. Burning Man is something that really is kind of a niche thing. You know, you don't find it really on the internet. You have to go there to be part of it. Attracts people from all over the world, though. So they said, well, what is this? So we're going to define the people that go to Burning Man as the guys from Wheaton did. They said, many burners, as they're known, are looking for the opportunity to express sides of them that they have ignored, repressed, or discounted. So this is looking for, say, the lawyer, his artistic side, or the doctor, his musical side, or, you know, the ability to build something or be part of something. So this is looking for things that people have ignored in their lives. For many burners, the good news they are longing to discover relates to achieving wholeness and expanding consciousness. Now, the expanding consciousness makes us think of Hare Krishnas and whatnot, but nevertheless, we can express that within Christian terms. When you come to recognize that you live in a enchanted world that God orders himself, a kind of secular way of saying that would be expanded consciousness, that we live in a God-ordered world where the God is making something happen through his creation. So that's what they're looking for, is expanded consciousness and achieving wholeness. And here we're not just talking about physical wholeness, but spiritual wholeness. And they get that through these experiences. For many burners, the good news they are longing to discover relates... Sorry, I read that one. Many burners are looking for a faith that is integrated with their bodies, sexuality, minds, hearts, creativity, imaginative sides, and larger social and cosmic environments. Does the church have that? Do we have a faith that is integrated with our bodies, sexuality, minds, hearts, creativity, imaginative sides, and larger social and cosmic environments? Yeah, we do. The question is really, I'm going to make it sound kind of crass, but it's marketing, right? So one of the problems that the guys at Wheaton discovered, which we'll see on the next slide, is how it's perceived, how the church is perceived. So what's kind of interesting is most of these folks that go to Burning Man that are de-churched, so to say, come out of mainline Christian Protestantism or Roman Catholic. That's where they're coming out of. So they're not really coming out of a church tradition that is imbued with history on a day-to-day basis, like you would find in an Orthodox Reformed church, some Anglican churches, some on the Orthodox side, where history is very much a part of worship and belief. You don't really see that in those mainline churches, and most Roman Catholic churches either. So they were missing this stuff, which in those churches, they kind of focus on the social piece, you know, but everything else is kind of left up to you. So we do have this. The problem is, on the other side of the marketing piece, who gets the press? So what you end up seeing on the news and online when it comes to the church, you don't see the people that are sitting in this room. You tend to see people that are screaming at somebody, and they're angry. Right, you end up seeing the church in Topeka. I forget the name of it. Yeah, the Baptist church in Topeka that goes to soldiers' funerals and protests that, you know, God hates gays and stuff like that. You end up seeing the lady in Kentucky. Regardless of what you think about it, she's probably not the best poster child for the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ. Just saying. So what you end up getting is a lot of people that go to Burning Man whose opinion of the church is formed either by their experiences being brought up in mainline Protestant churches, you know, they went to First United Methodist, or it's formed by what they see on television and read in newspapers and online, or both. So that's kind of what we're dealing with. So, continuing on, about 90% of the people who the Wheaton guys interviewed at Burning Man were from mainline Protestant Catholic churches backgrounds. They are de-churched. We talked about that. Many church people think of Burning Man as a wild party with naked jugged up and fairly secular or even pagan people. So, there is, it does exist, obviously, but is that everybody that's there? According to Wheaton, it's not everybody. So, but is this going to create a problem for us if we were to engage with the Burning Man group of people? If that's the perspective that we approach them with, then that's going to affect it. Now, many, inverse is also true, what they view, how they look at us. So many burners think of the church as a narrow, judgmental, gay-bashing, repressed institution whose time and relevance have passed. Well, let's see. Is that true? Well, the people that get press, usually that's fairly representative of who's on television, because it's usually two people screaming at each other on Fox News. So, again, how do we present the gospel to people? How we present the gospel to people is directly going to impact how people perceive the church, and either draw them in or push them away. What was interesting was a couple folks from Wheaton College, not from the graduate school, set up a tent there, and it was just if you wanted someone to pray with you. And there was a student in there, and they would just, and they weren't out there, you know, forcing people to come in or even asking people to come in. They just set up a tent and had a little sign up and said, "We'll pray with you." And there was a line of people outside this tent of Burning Man hippie folks that wanted someone to pray with them. So it's in these experiences, you know, the church of secularism at Burning Man, there's a desperation for God that exists there, that people are actually open, and that was the other thing that was in this report on Burning Man, that most of the people there were actually open to the gospel, to hearing the gospel. Most of them also had wrong ideas about what the gospel was. They kind of believed the gospel was more that TED Talk gospel, that we're going to give you some tips and tricks to live a better life, we're going to kick you out the door, and we'll see you next week, and we'll give you your next treatment. That was how they understood the gospel, until presented with what the gospel actually is. Apparently, there were some really, really neat conversations that happened there with the folks that were attending it. So that's kind of interesting as well. So one of the last things with regard to Burning Man that the folks at Wheaton said was these dimensions are fundamental to our humanity and identity. So talking about those that list of stuff on the previous slide with regard to identity, sexuality, cosmic and social well-being and all this kind of stuff. These dimensions are fundamental to our humanity and identity and need articulation, engagement at an authentic and profoundly personal and biblical level. So what that means is putting up a sign on the highway that says God loves you is not really the approach that's going to work with the Burning Man set. They actually thrive on relationships, the folks that attend that. They thrive on authenticity and an organic relationship. So what that means is not just, you know, having information injected into your brain housing group, but, you know, being someplace, being with people. And we see that reflected in the gospel. I mean, how much of the gospel is centered around food, right? Or how many times does the gospel talk about praying on your knees? You know, I mean, it's not just this kind of, and this is what we as the church can present to them, is not this, you know, cerebral information injection into your brain, but actually that organic faith that we all experience on a day-to-day basis. I mean, gee whiz, the communion table. So these are the pieces that are missing from that Burning Man set, as opposed to the TED Talk set who are looking for law. These people are looking for the cross, they're just looking in the wrong place. Both of them are in desperate need, though. And so we get to how do we deal with that? So I put a question slide here, but this is more just kind of open for discussion on, you know, what are the other places? I gave you two, TED Talks and Burning Man. What are the other worship experiences in the secular world that you see? Just throw them out there. Westboro Baptist, that was right. Yeah. So that, I mean, that's almost a we could say the gay community is almost a worshiping community because they have communion, they have fellowship, they have communion, hospitality. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Ooh, yeah, that's a good one. Actually, I didn't think about that. These get rich quick schemes where, and it was funny because I was up in Chicago a few weeks ago. And that's a great example. We were staying in a Holiday Inn in Chicago and they had one of these get rich quick schemes. And I remember I'm sitting out there having a cup of coffee and I'm looking at these people as they're arriving for the morning conference. And, you know, my heart went out to them because in each of them you could see that they had gotten to a point in life where this was a gospel that was being presented to them for salvation. You know, things had not gone well for them. And you could see that in their faces. You could see it in the way they were dressed, the way they behaved, that they were in desperate need of help. And you could see it just in the way they walked and looked at people. There was a sense of shame and a sense of helplessness among them. And they get in there and you get somebody up there saying, yes, you can do it. You know, gosh darn it, people like you, you know. It's a sermon, but it's also communion. It's a worship practice. You know, there are worship practices involved in that. That's a good example. Yes, sir. Yeah, televangelism, even, right? I mean, talk shows. But I think Oprah presents something really interesting because there is a gospel there for sure that she's presenting to people. And she's presenting it to broken people, people that are struggling with various issues and how they're going to solve it. But she's definitely presenting law, I would say, right? I mean, she definitely presents tips and tricks to fix your problems. But then again, she gives away cars, right? So there is some salvation there, I guess, if you're in need of a car.
It even comes down to a smaller area, for example, the family.
Mm-hmm. The family.
Worshiping their children.
Right. No, exactly.
Their children are everything. Don't get me wrong. It's wonderful to love your children.
Right.
I know you do. I know I do. But when everything is life revolves around and is totally focused on what do I have to do to make my child happy and to make me proud of my child all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And even to the point where some people live so vicariously through their children that they actually beat their kids up for not performing well enough to make them look like
the tiger mom.
Yeah, yeah.
The tiger mom would be. Are you all familiar with the tiger mom? Probably, yeah. Hey, that would be a perfect example of. It is a form of worship. It's definitely a law-based worship.
Yes.
But, yeah, it's definitely worship. So, you know, being able to look at in the secular world, you know, the various secular worship practices that are out there are actually really helpful for us. And for two reasons. One is so that we know how to speak to the unbeliever, so that we know how to present the gospel to them. So if we understand their worship practices, we can better explain our worship practices and why the worship of Christ is so glorious. The second part, and we'll get into this more in the coming weeks, is being able to root out secular worship in our own lives. So how do we see the gospel of glory that the secular world presents moving into our lives? How does it get into our hearts? And then how do we get it out? And that's a question that we constantly have to kind of address in this, because we can't get away from the secular world, right? So people that move on compounds, probably we need to call the cops, right? So unless we're all going to live on a compound, we're not going to be able to separate ourselves from the secular world. And even then, someone's going to have to, you know, we're still going to need the internet because kids play World of Warcraft. So how do we need to be able to identify these secular worship practices because they will affect the way we do our own lives. And that'll be everything from, you know, dealing with the fact that we're not living up to the standard that the secular world presents, you know, whether that's in the way that we dress, the car we drive, the way we keep our house, what food we feed our kids, all the way up through, you know, how much money is in our checkbook, and am I recycling, and all the other laws that the secular world gives us. Now, the problem is the balance that is there, is that how it affects our heart. So obviously we know that, generally speaking, recycling is kind of a good thing, right? So it's good to do it. But is it law? Have I introduced it into my heart as law? And do I judge myself and other people based on that law? And that's kind of how we, as the church, need to address the secular world as well. Is there law in the Bible? Yeah, absolutely. There's also the gospel. And how do we present that to them so that they don't see Westboro Baptist and assume that that's the gospel? So it's being able to explain that to people. Next week, what I'm going to do is start with the answer to secularism. It'll be the first of two answers to secularism. So what we'll do is the first one will be addressing secularism's demands of us, and then how we respond to it. And then there'll be a second answer to secularism and how we respond to it. So it's two answers dealing with two separate problems. And then at the end of that, we'll start to get into how do we then live as the church in the secular world. And that'll be kind of where we tie it up. So were there any questions on what we talked about today? Any disagreements? I like disagreements. I like arguments. Not bad arguments, but, you know. Any thoughts? Have I? No. I actually would like to go because seeing something that big burn would be really cool. It's a giant bonfire. The man they build, I think it's like 5 stories tall out of wood. And then at the end of the week, they set it on fire. Apparently it's a really big thing. Yes, sir. Should we blow it up instead? That'd be kind of cool. Launch it. But yeah, I mean, there's also a worship practice embedded in that. I mean, nobody would probably be able to articulate it that way, but definitely with this idea that we're going to build this gigantic structure, it's going to be a pretty cool art piece, and then we're going to burn it to the ground at the end. There's definitely probably elements of idol worship built into that, and I'm not saying that, you know, idols, run away. But, you know, that out of their hearts is coming an idol worship in building this thing and then burning it, but also some worship practice, other kind of worship practices involved in it. And then the fact that everyone likes to stand around and stare at fire anyway. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. It's been said before, and I don't know, I forget who said it, but said that if you write a self-help book, that is the quickest way to become a millionaire. You know, and that's part, one of the largest sections within Barnes & Noble is a self-help section, because people are looking for law.
Even in the evangelical church, if you don't understand law and gospel appropriately,
mm-hmm.
because I grew up in a church where I was at the altar every week,
mm-hmm.
you know, because apparently it didn't stick to the guy.
Mm-hmm.
My worship was convoluted in a way.
Yeah.
Because I didn't understand, you know, that concept, that interaction.
Yeah.
That's necessary, that apparently is what these folks are looking for.
Right.
But they're not doing.
And the other piece to that as well is the intersection between law and worship.
Right.
That following law, getting law, has a worship aspect to it because it allows us to be in control and to do something to deserve something. So there is a worship practice embedded in that as well that really needs to be discussed with the secular world, that when we're talking to people that we understand that the reason nothing's being demanded of you is because it's already been done for you. You know, I mean, that what's demanded of you is your faith, not the works of your hands. So anyway, that about brings us to the end for today.